Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. A new Missouri law bans meat alternatives, anything that doesn't come from livestock or chickens, from being called meat. The Missouri law also applies to something that isn't yet on the market, lab-grown meat. That's what we're talking about today. Washington Post columnist Tamar Haspel wrote about lab-grown meat for Vox. You can check that story out at a link at WOSU.org/allsides. Tamar Haspel joins us by phone now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann. Glad to be here.
So what do we mean by lab-grown meat? What is it?
Lab-grown meat is actual meat in that it's made from animal cells. It starts with bona fide animal cells from the living, breathing animal. And scientists take those cells into the laboratory, and they put it in what's called a bioreactor, which is, you know, what you and I would know as a vat, where you can control all kinds of things. You can control, obviously, temperature and pH level and oxygen and all that stuff. And in the vat, they put a growth medium that mimics the kind of serum that a growing embryo would experience in the animal as it was growing, and a scaffolding that they put these cells on. The cells grow, and they turn into what is indistinguishable from meat because it's actual meat cells, except you're just getting the animal out of the loop once you get those few cells from it in the first place.
So when you cut through it, it looks like a piece of chicken?
Well, we're a ways away from that.
Okay.
It's in the beginning, it's going to be look more like a piece of sausage. The whole meat, like a steak or a chicken breast, presents challenges of its own. So initially, we're looking at things that are more like hamburger or sausage.
How big is this? I mean, are there lots of companies working on this?
There are lots of companies working on this. And one of the key indicators here are who's backing those companies. Mm-hmm. Because it is right now years away from being a viable technology. But should it become viable, imagine the possibilities. It can essentially, the best case scenario for a lot of the people in this industry is that it would replace meat altogether. Other people see it as just being a significant part of the meat market. But it's not just these little startup companies, although there are a lot of them. Some of the biggest meat companies are investing in them. So Tyson, for example, is putting money into this because Tyson is essentially in the protein production business, and if they can produce the protein without having to actually raise animals and deal with the welfare issues and the pollution issues and the climate change issues that come with that, they're going to want to do that.
Missouri passed a law to more narrowly define what is marketed as meat. And how has the lab-grown meat industry responded to the Missouri law? Do they see this as a harbinger?
I'm not sure that they do. I think that in the end, it's going to be what happens at the federal level that really determines what these things are going to be called rather than a hodgepodge of state regulations. And keep in mind, one of the things that, you know, in some ways is working against this product is that it's years out, but in some ways it's working for this product because since it's years out, the regulatory agencies have some time to figure these things out. And there are a lot of players who are not opposed to calling it meat. The players who are opposed to calling it meat tend to be the cattlemen's associations and things like that. But keep in mind, when you have Tyson backing this, there are some very vested interests who are going to be on the side of calling it meat.
Right now, it's super expensive to produce this stuff, right?
Super duper expensive. Thousands of dollars a pound.
So I assume you haven't tried it yet.
I have not tried it yet. Well, they didn't offer me any when I was doing the story.
Well, has anybody tried it?
Yeah, some people have tried it. And the reports from the people who have tried it are that it tastes just like meat.
Yeah.
So, at this point, we really don't have that much to go on. But it is, I should point out, it's a little bit different from, you know, they're like the Beyond Burger, for example, where you tend to have people who are vegetarian, who are actively looking for a meat replacement, report that it tastes just like meat, whereas people who are carnivorous report that maybe it doesn't taste just like meat. Mm-hmm. In this case, it really is meat, so there's no reason to suspect that it's going to taste a lot different.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. With me is Tamara Haspel. She's a Washington Post columnist. She wrote an article about lab-produced meat for Vox. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question or a comment for Tamara Haspel, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. So we've got Tyson actually investing in this food of the future, perhaps. But more of the independents out there are saying, yeah, I don't think so, or at least they don't want it to be confused with what we call meat now.
Yeah, I think when I took a look at this, the people who were most concerned about it were the cattlemen. And so it's, you know, the people who are working hard to raise actual genuine beef. But, you know, the beef industry is much bigger than that. The people who grow the animals are just this one part. And if you go up the processing chain to then you start running into the Tysons and the Cargills, you don't find that same entrenched resistance. So I actually, you know, I went into writing this story figuring that there would be a whole lot of opposition to this from people on the meat side of the business, but it's a lot more complicated than that, and I really didn't find that many groups who expressed a really sort of diehard opposition to this.
Is there any downside to this?
We don't really know yet, because we don't really know what it's going to look like when we produce it at scale. So right now, these things are being grown in vats that are, you know, a few liters. So we have no idea what the impact, the environmental impact of this is going to be when it scales up. And that's something that people are going to be watching very closely, because, of course, one of the rationale for going in this route rather than actually eating beef that comes from a living animal is the environmental impact. And if this process turns out to be tremendously fossil fuel intensive and you know, produces greenhouse gases of the same magnitude, then obviously we don't have a big win here. But most of the people I spoke with, although, you know, there's no numbers on the table, most of the people I spoke with were fairly optimistic that the life cycle analysis was going to show that this is a much more environmentally friendly process than actually rearing, slaughtering, and processing animals.
In your article for Vox, you wrote that 1 in 10 people even know about lab-grown meat. What do we know about who they are?
Well, they tend to be, you know, younger, unsurprisingly. They tend to be technologically inclined, also unsurprisingly. But because it's so new and so unfamiliar to people, it's very difficult to make predictions about who is going to latch on to this, who is going to be maybe disgusted by it or opposed to it, because whenever we put something in the food supply that is viewed as quote-unquote unnatural, you know, some people balk. And so it's really early in the game. So, you know, I think anyone who pulls out a crystal ball at this point is taking a big risk, and I'm not going to do it as far as who's going to adopt this. Now, if we take the long, long, long view, it's hard for me to see that this wouldn't have some role down the line in producing meat.
How about ethicists? Have science ethicists gotten in the act yet?
You know, I don't think that it's been a big issue in this conversation, mostly because what you end up with is fewer ethical considerations rather than more. You're not creating life in the lab. You're just letting cells reproduce, or you're coaxing them to reproduce, something that the tissue generation segment of the medical industry has been doing for a very long time. And so a lot of the ethical considerations work the other way as far as animal welfare issues, as far as pollution issues. I think it's seen more as an ethical solution than an ethical problem, which is not to say that people won't voice objections to it, but so far I haven't seen a lot of that.
What about just the process itself? How much regulation does that warrant at this? What do they envision, they being the industry, envision as far as regulations go?
Well, isn't that the $64,000 question? right now, the regulatory agencies, and you know, there are two of them basically involved in this, the FDA and the USDA, and they're figuring out as you know, we go through this process, who is going to have responsibility for what parts of this regulation. And, you know, the split of responsibility between those two agencies is really arcane. And there are some precedents for this because the FDA does regulate medicine and things grown in bioreactors, so they know something about that. The USDA is more accustomed to, you know, regulating food safety in the live meat chain. And what they have to regulate is actually not that different from what they'd have to regulate for other kinds of foods. And I talked to Greg Jaffe, who's a lawyer at the Center for Science and the Public Interest and has been following this very closely. And, you know, he said it's a lot of the same stuff. They have to make sure that all of the substances involved in the manufacture are safe. They have to make sure that there are no allergens in this product, or if there are, we know what they are and they're clearly identified. We have to make sure that the process is regulated in such a way that pathogens don't have an opportunity to get in and make us sick. And so it's going to develop as the product develops, just what those regulations look like. It's going to be complicated because of the two agencies being involved, but in some ways it's actually fairly straightforward, and it's something that the government, I would argue, is relatively good at.
You know, when it comes to the grains that are available on a mass scale, there is a lot of concern, and there are seed banks created because of that, that the diversity of our food supply is becoming very narrow. Is there a concern about that, that we, if we were to ever become too reliant on lab produce, that we would lose diversity in the importance of that, that we can't necessarily predict going forward?
Well, I guess I'd argue that we have already lost diversity. Basically, almost all of the meat we consume in this country comes from pigs, broiler chickens, and cattle. And I think the cattle has the most diverse genome out there. But the pigs and the chickens are all pretty similar. And, you know, I guess I would hope that this would not be a replacement for animals, but an adjunct to animals. And as long as animals still play some role in our food system, and there are some pretty compelling reasons that they should, then I don't think we're under threat of losing any more diversity than we already have.
We are talking about lab-produced meat, chicken, beef. Is it meat? What do you think, listeners? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. It is not available yet, but it will be. My guest is Tamar Haspel. She's a Washington Post columnist, and she wrote an article about lab-produced meat for Vox. We'll have a link to that article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. You should check it out. In the meantime, stay with us. We're going to continue our conversation. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about lab-grown meat today. It's not a thing. You cannot buy it yet, but it is certainly a thing that's being heavily invested in and heavily studied, and they're working on it. A San Francisco-based company, Just, is planning to sell lab-grown chicken in restaurants outside the U.S. by year's end. Lab meat doesn't come from a farm, but some industry observers expect some type of regulation. Still with us by phone is journalist Tamar Haspel. Her Vox article about lab-grown meat is on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Joining us now by phone is Ohio State University food science and technology professor Lynn Knipe. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Lynn, you said in an article that the term clean used in clean meat is misleading when it comes to referring to lab-produced meat. How so?
Well, for me, the first thing that I think of is that implies that our other meat is not clean. And I know that the name originated from a couple of things. One is that there's less of an environmental impact that can be recognized with some of our meat production. There isn't that, what some people might call the ick factor, that people might associate with, you know, the old comment about watching sausage and laws being made.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also, where it probably comes the closest, is that we don't have to worry about any cross-contamination with pathogens, environmental pathogens, that we might come across occasionally with meat processing. So that might be the closest that comes to being cleaner, but I just think it reflects badly on the fact that, and we have a very heavily inspected meat supply,
mm-hmm.
and I just question the use of the word clean.
Is that a controversy, Tamar Haspel?
Yeah, it is. What to call it, people are going back and forth about that a lot. And, you know, Lynn makes a really good point. I mean, clean is a deliberate effort by this industry, which is often motivated by a dislike of conventional meat or live animal meat. A lot of them have vegetarian agendas and things like that. And by calling it clean, they imply that the other stuff is dirty. It's a marketing term. You know, for purposes for right now, I go with lab grown because it seems to me to describe the process. But, you know, we've got several years to try and iron that out, but it is an important thing to iron out.
Yeah, lab grown is accurate, it's precise, but doesn't play well on a label, right?
Right, it is right. Not delicious.
Yeah, right. Lynn, you've talked about the issue of lab grown meat and regulation. Who, in theory, do you think should be in charge of regulating this emerging market? How would it be different?
Well, that's a very good question. Things would be quite different if it was being regulated by USDA, Food Safety Inspection Service, and if it has a meat component to it, it would have to be under that inspection. What the concern is really the safety of this product. And there are some current products out there that aren't necessarily the cultured or the lab grown, but they are under FDA inspection. And I think that's the concern that I would have, is if this lab grown product is under FDA inspection, will the consumers be adequately protected as far as food safety?
Why would that concern you?
Well, we have an issue with FDA is in charge of all other food products, and they don't have near the manpower that the Food Safety Inspection Service has.
Okay,
and so we don't have near the number of people out there watching. And we've made some changes. There's something called generally recognized as safe. And there's even some products on the market right now. They're not the cultured products, but they are non-meat products that are getting quite a bit of attention. And they're burgers. I guess I should say they're burgers.
Uh-huh.
And they have some ingredients in them that we really have not adequately tested the safety of them. So I think that's my concern is, FDA's focus is obviously on the drug. You know, the drug industry is a bigger part of their business, I believe. And so I worry about how this is going to be inspected, how we're going to be able to be sure it's really safe.
And Tamar Haspel, any thoughts by the people that you interviewed about when regulation should kick in? Should they wait until it actually is brought onto the market? Will it be a period of time before it's brought to the market? Of course, in the U.S., the rest of the world's a different story.
I think the key issue here is before. And that's when people want this regulation to be in place. And, you know, if you look at some of the recent controversies, and Lynn, I think you were referring to heme in one of, I believe it's the Impossible Burger, which is the ingredient that has raised some eyebrows. Because that went out on the market before the FDA had a chance to weigh in on it, or that I believe that was in process as they brought it onto the market, that, again, raises eyebrows. So the idea that we have time to get all of this in place before this stuff hits the market, and we have years, is in some ways it's encouraging. But there's actually another angle to the whole FDA versus USDA controversy here, and there's a political angle. I know you're shocked. But
you know, I was trying to keep politics out of the show.
I know.
For just one day.
I'm raining on your parade.
That's okay.
Here. But it's actually kind of interesting because it puts opponents to these products between a little bit of a rock and a hard place, because the meat, the cattlemen, the meat industry would like the USDA to regulate it because the meat industry has ties to the USDA. Mm-hmm. They've been working together for a long time. They wield some influence at the USDA. But in order for the USDA to regulate it as meat, they have to let it be called meat. Hmm. So they have to pick their poison on this one.
The other agency is more food related, right?
Food and drug.
Food and drug, right. 614-292-8513 is the number to call if you have a question about our topic today. We're talking about lab-grown meat. You can't find it in the grocery store yet, but you will in a matter of a few years. Apparently, they're growing it, and they're going to be serving it in restaurants outside of the United States. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guests are Tamar Haspel. She's a Washington Post columnist, and she wrote an article for Vox about lab-grown meat. Also with us, Lynn Knipe. He's an OSU associate professor who works and focuses as much of his work on meat processing. Let's see. Eric in Delaware, you're on the air. Oops. Sorry, he's not ready. Can we expect to see more laws like the one in Missouri that prohibits, that deals with what things are called? Tamar?
Yeah, I think we can, because it's not just meat. It's the butter people and the milk people, because as more and more things come out in the market specifically geared toward replacing dairy foods and animal products, the more controversial the use of the term butter or milk or meat becomes. And so, you know, nobody cared when it was peanut butter, but when it's something, and, you know, look at what happened with you mentioned the company Just, one of their earlier products was Just Mayo. Mm. And Unilever launched a lawsuit to disallow that. They subsequently retracted it. But, you know, you're goring the ox of some of the biggest industries out there, and, yeah, you're going to hear about it in court.
It kind of makes me think of, well, is that why they named that margarine, I Can't Believe It's Not Butter?
Right, I know. You've got to get that butter in there.
Lynn Knipe, this isn't a joking matter, I'm sure. Does what we call something matter, Lynn?
Well, yes. In fact, both FDA and USDA take it very seriously how we label and brand things. And it might surprise you with all the things you hear about with recalls. I know this is the case in the meat industry. It may also be in the food industry. The number one cause for recalls is misbranding or mislabeling. And it's usually related to a product that actually may have some milk protein in it or may have some soy protein in it, but they've either picked the wrong label or they printed the wrong label. And so for protecting the consumers, that product has to be recalled or relabeled or whatever. So there's a big emphasis put on details like that. So how can we mislabel something? I mean, we have a situation, and I know I may be causing a problem in my own industry. We have turkey hams, and I have yet to find a ham on a turkey.
Mm.
But we've been allowed to label that for probably 25 years. But I think the more recent ones are the milk products, and we have a number of things out there that are being called things that to me aren't right.
Is milk something that only can come from a mammal?
I believe that's the as I understand that's the standard of identity.
Okay.
Well, we've been drinking coconut milk for an awful long time,
mm-hmm.
and soy milk too. And, you know, I think what's telling about this is that, you know, when it was just coconut milk, nobody cared. When soy milk entered in the market, if memory serves, there was some controversy, but it was fairly limited. But it's only when this really becomes a threat to the industry, to the dairy industry, that it's worth really battling over. And, you know, I guess I got to say, I am not persuaded that consumers are going to be confused by this. I think, you know, I think people know the difference between coconut milk, soy milk, almond milk, and milk.
Mm-hmm.
But again, this is something that is going to be argued about probably for quite some time until they enshrine it in the standards of identity.
Steve in Pataskala, you're on the air. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Yeah, they've already, I mean, industrially, they're producing stuff like gel and gum and corn syrup and things like that. But I'm vegan, but for my fellow omnivores, how do they produce this meat? I mean, do they have a cell that just replicates and replicates? Is it like a HeLa cell that just over time reproduces itself and they just keep feeding it in a culture of nutrition? Or it just sounds kind of nutty to me, but
well, it's happening, Steve. But Tamar Haspel, for the lay people out there like me, you've said they get some cells from a real animal, and
right. And you know, depending on what the cells are and what the medium is, you can grow up cells, you can go bad cells, you can go other kinds of cells as well. So it does sound nutty often to vegans. And the process, I think, is going to be different, depend on who's doing it. Different companies have different stratagems with different kinds of cells and different kind of media. But, yeah, that's the basic idea. You take cells from an animal and you put them in a medium, and they do what cells do, which is produce. At some point, I believe you have to refresh the cell lines. You can't just keep using the same ones over and over and over. But better you talk to a scientist on that to get the last.
Steve in Pataskala, thanks for that call. We are going to take a quick break. We will be right back. We'll continue our conversation about lab-grown meat. Tamar Haspel of The Washington Post, thanks for joining us.
For having me.
Tamar Haspel of The Washington Post wrote a piece for Vox about lab-produced meat. We'll have a link to that on our website at wosu.org/allsides. And I also have to say thanks and goodbye to Lynn Knipe of Ohio State University. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Lynn Knipe is an OSU associate professor. His work focuses on meat processing. We'll continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The
This is 89.7 NPR News. In about 20 minutes, On Point begins. Listen to On Point weekdays from noon until 2. A mix of sun and clouds, a high of 60 today.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Coming up on the next On Point, James Allison won the Nobel Prize for his landmark work on the immune system and cancer treatment. We'll talk with him and other top researchers on where we are in the search for a cure. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Today at noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about lab-grown meat today. It's not in the market yet, but it will be in a matter of years. The likes of Tyson are investing in this meat of the future, I guess. If you want to call it meat, that's another issue, is what you call it. It is not boding well sitting well with livestock farmers. The United States Cattlemen's Association filed a petition with the Department of Agriculture to more narrowly define what is called beef and meat, and whether or not that should include lab-grown meat. They also are asking to exclude lab-grown meat from being labeled as such. Joining us now is the education director for the Columbus Veg Community, Evan Thomas. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
So your focus is on plant-based food, whether it's proteins or not. What do you think about the idea of lab produced meat?
I would call it clean meat myself, partly because clean meat is kind of like the clean energy of food. Conventionally produced animal products are very environmentally destructive in multiple ways, in terms of water pollution, contribution to climate change. This is a big issue right now. So I'm really personally excited about clean meat, especially because this is a way that we're going to be able to cut back on our impact on the environment with our personal, food choices. And also, we're going to be able to move away from these large industrial farming techniques where, yeah.
But might we be moving toward these large industrial laboratories?
Well, I wouldn't use the word lab. Lots of foods are originally developed in a lab. Lots of the foods that we're eating today are developed in labs. But then, once they are developed, they'll start being produced in a separate facility. And you don't really call those facilities labs. I mean, a lab is where a scientist is doing experiments. But once we know how to create this clean meat, we won't be experimenting with it in that same way anymore. So we'll see it being produced in facilities comparable to like breweries where you see beer produced.
Hmm. And the clean then aspect to you is kind of, it's a moral issue. A lot of people don't eat meat because of the impact on the environment and the treatment of animals, right?
Yeah, I mean, people choose plant-based options for all kinds of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I am motivated by my concern about the treatment of animals and impact on the environment. It's also an option that people choose because of they want to be choosing healthy options. Or they're concerned about the treatment of humans on some of these agricultural settings. So, yeah, people choose plant-based options for all kinds of reasons.
What kind of debate is going on, though, in the vegan/vegetarian community surrounding lab-grown meat? Is everyone on board like you are?
Oh, definitely not. there's controversies about everything within the vegan movement. So one issue is, my understanding is that they are currently still using what's called fetal bovine serum in creating these foods.
It's part of that is what Tamar described as it's like you would with a fetus. It's what nurtures it.
That's right. Yeah. So this is they get it from fetal cows, and it's got like the right mixture of proteins for these cells to be replicating in mm-hmm. the right kind of way. And I've heard that these companies that are working on clean meat are planning to phase out fetal bovine serum by the end of this year.
Just making it synthetically?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure. I'm not familiar with the technical details, but maybe they'll be artificially synthesizing some of those proteins.
And so that's a problem that people have.
For vegans, definitely. I mean, even if we continued to use fetal bovine serum, I think this would still be a major net plus in terms of animal welfare and in terms of environmental impact. But if you are looking for a product that has no ties to the exploitation of animals at all, you would want to have fetal bovine serum.
What else are people concerned about?
Well, you know, so a lot of people are concerned about the fact that this is going to kind of make us feel comfortable continuing to consume these products when we know that the rate at which we're consuming these products is pretty damaging for our health. You know, the science is pretty settled. According to the World Health Organization, processed meat is a class one carcinogen. In particular, it's tied to colon cancer.
Is going to be pretty processed.
Well, it depends on what you mean by process, but it could be turned into processed meat products. I mean, the World Health Organization also classifies red meat as a class 2A carcinogen, which means that it's a probable carcinogen. So the science isn't fully settled, but, you know, we have enough evidence to say that red meat probably causes cancer. So, you know, if you probably don't want cancer, you don't want to be eating too much red meat. So some vegans are concerned that clean meat will lead to more people feeling comfortable choosing to consume a large quantity of these products in their diets, which could be harmful to their health.
Listeners, what do you think? Would you eat lab-produced meat? Do you have any qualms about it? Are you eager to see what comes out in the next few years? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Right now I'm talking with Evan Thomas of Columbus Veg Community, where he's education director. Does it matter how the animal cells are taken to start these strains?
Well, so my understanding is that clean chicken products have been created by plucking like a single feather and collecting a couple cells off the end of that.
And you're okay with that?
Myself, I am definitely okay with that.
Uh-huh.
So I don't think that this is going to require invasive extraction techniques that are going to be harmful to animals.
And if someone is an avid meat eater, what is your recommendation for turning to clean meat, just because it's clean as in clean energy, clean?
Yeah, I mean, so even if you're an avid meat eater, you're probably not someone who wants to cause animals suffering. No one's really happy about how the vast majority of animals in our food system are treated. You know, we might choose to still eat animal products because, you know, we don't really have the time or the energy to figure out new ways to cook food that are tasty. But if you could just choose a different option and you knew that by choosing this clean meat product, you know, no animals were raised in, you know, intensive confinement where they couldn't turn around. I think, you know, you could still care about animal welfare. And this is, again, also going to be a really important step towards keeping, you know, life on this planet viable in terms of our environmental impact.
Tom, and is it Clinton?
Clintonville.
Clintonville. Okay. Thanks. Tom, welcome. You're on the air.
Thanks. Hey, I had a comment. I tried. White Castle right now is testing the, I think they call it the Impossible Burger. And just out of curiosity, I tried it. It's quite expensive. It's $2.50 for one slider versus, I think, $1 or something like that for their regular meat. And the taste profile was okay, but it really fell apart easily. I think so. I think this category has some you know, meat around it per se, but it still has some refinement. It fell apart pretty easily, and it was expensive. That was my opinion on it.
Now, the Impossible Burger is plant-based, right? Evan Thomas?
Yeah, that's right. So the Impossible Burger is currently carried at all the White Castles here in Columbus. I've heard pretty similar things from other people that have tried it. They tell me, oh, it's really, really beefy. I mean, I can notice some differences. I mean, that's one place where clean meat can come in, right? With clean meat, we've got actual meat. So we won't have any subtle differences.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, I'm also expecting the price of the Impossible Burger to come down. You know, this is really just a matter of scaling up and achieving economies of scale. So I think that within the next couple of years, we might start seeing plant-based versions of all these major products that are actually cheaper than animal products.
Okay. Tom, thanks for that call. 614-292-8513 is the number to call if you have a question or comment. We're talking about lab-produced meat, the viability of it. It's not on the market yet. It will be rolling out into restaurants outside of the United States, where the where the regulations aren't as strict as they are here. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. What about what they're called? Now, you embrace the clean meat moniker, but calling them meat at all, some organizations, as we mentioned, the Cattlemen's Association and so forth, are opposed to even that.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I understand the reservation of people that are working in traditional livestock agriculture, right? I mean, they feel threatened by these industries. You know, and I think that we should, you know, as clean meat becomes the norm, I think maybe we should have governmental programs that help people working in livestock transition into other forms of employment. But I don't think it really makes sense for us to try to stifle innovation by fighting over how we call these products.
Unless you're in competition with them, and then stifling innovation is the name of the game, right?
Right, yeah. But, you know, we've got to go in the clean meat direction, just environmentally speaking. I mean, this report that came out from the IPCC just the other day, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, you know, we are in for a world of changes, some really serious environmental issues in the next decade. And clean meat is going to be absolutely essential for dealing with those issues.
If we want to continue eating what we think of as meat.
That's right, yeah.
The Columbus Veg community, tell me about that and what you guys do.
Yeah, so we're a local 501c3 all-volunteer-run nonprofit. Our mission is to make trying vegan food and learning about veganism as fun, friendly, and accessible as possible. So, you know, we do educational outreach events. We go speak in high schools. We talk at OSU. And we really just want people to try vegan food and to know that even if you're not ready to go vegan, you know, trying vegan meals a couple days a week, finding foods that you like and enjoying them as often as you can is a great thing to do for your health and for animals and for the environment. Yeah.
How well do you think the processed food industry has responded to the growing demand for vegan food?
Kind of vegan processed food industry is growing rapidly. There's
right.
a lot of investment in it. People recognize that consumers are demanding these types of foods. I mean, just in the past couple of years, we have seen a huge increase in interest in veganism here in Columbus. You know, because of documentaries like Cowspiracy or What the Health, people are coming to us and they're saying, you know, I just watched this documentary. Oh, my God, I had no idea how much animal agriculture is impacting the environment or how much it's impacting my health. And I want to start making these changes towards a plant-based direction. So we're there to help people that are interested in taking any steps towards a plant-based diet.
What about restaurants? I mean, and what about labeling the meat that we eat in restaurants in the going forward? What do you think the responsibilities are there?
As far as like labeling like clean meat as clean
yeah.
meat? Yeah, I mean, I think that makes sense. I mean,
so you know what you're getting.
Yeah, so consumers like myself, you know, once clean meat is available, I might eat it occasionally. Personally, I'm not going to make any animal product a consistent part of my diet because I am convinced about the health benefits of, you know, minimizing or eliminating those products. But, you know, I'd like to try it, but I don't want to be eating any conventionally produced meat. So, you know, if there's a restaurant that says you can get your traditional chicken nuggets or you can get your clean meat chicken nuggets, I want to know which ones are the clean meat chicken nuggets so that I can give them a try.
And you think that there'll be a demand for that?
Oh, definitely. I think that there's going to be a huge consumer demand for these products. And I think that within 10 years, it's probably going to be cheaper than conventionally produced meat. And I think at that point, it's probably going to become the norm.
When did you become aware of lab-produced meats? What triggered your interest or your awareness of that?
I'm just kind of my familiarity with the vegan movement, kind of vegan news sources online. I think I probably learned about clean meat about a year ago.
The first time I looked into it was a few years ago. I can't remember exactly how many, but when there was sort of a hoax out there that a big fast food restaurant was using lab-produced chicken.
Yeah.
And I thought, is that even a thing? And as I looked into it, that was sort of in the infancy of the movement, but they were starting to work on it.
Right, yeah. So my understanding is that 2013 was the first year in which a clean meat hamburger was produced. And at that time, it cost, I think, $330,000 to produce. But they've already got the price down to like $40 a gram. So, you know, this is an industry that's really just booming right now.
Let's hear from Kevin in California. You're on the air. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Ann. My question was, right now you're talking a lot about meat, but there are a lot of other animal byproducts like leather wallets, leather belts, leather purses. Is there any research on that front, or are we going to stick to synthetic leather like we have now, or is it going to be lab-grown leather?
Well, that's a good question, and that has been raised, but I don't know if they've come up with any kind of answers to that. Evan Thomas, I mean, that's another issue for a lot of they no leather, no nothing.
Yeah, so my understanding is that there are startups working on all different types of animal byproducts. So they're going to, you know, there are startups working on leather. There are startups working on milk, dairy products.
Lab producing
it? Yeah, lab producing it, using the same kind of basic technology.
Well, Kevin, what do you think? Oh, I guess he's gone. Okay. And that is what, it's the same thing. It would fulfill a need without the objections that people who don't use leather have today.
That's right. Yeah. So, you know, as we move away from raising animals for meat, we're also going to need to find a different source for our leather products. And we will be able to produce the leather in the same exact way. So you just take a couple cells, get them to replicate in the right kind of nutritional medium, and, you know, with the right processes, end up with a piece of leather that is biologically and chemically identical to a piece of leather that was produced from an actual cow.
Pat in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Pat.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Sure. We're getting short on time, so I wanted to quick squeeze you in.
Kroger's has meat substitutes like corn, Daiya, Morningstar already.
Yeah.
So you said it's not available yet.
No, lab-produced meat is not available.
Lab-produced is available at Quorn, Quorn.
Right. So corn is made, I think, partially through a kind of like a kind of mushroom that's grown in a lab. So that might have been why she was referring to it as lab-grown. But it's not meat, it's plant-based. It's plant-based, yeah.
Okay, yeah. I mean, that's what we've been talking about, Pat. It's not available yet in stores or restaurants, and the regulators are starting to, they're trying to hit the ground running on this issue. So thanks for that call, Pat. Evan Thomas, thanks to you for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much.
I want to remind folks to join us, join WSU Public Media and me for Politics in a Pint tonight at Seven Suns Brewing's new rooftop bar. It's from 6 to 8 p.m. I'll be there with Columbus on the Record host Mike Thompson to talk politics while you sip on craft brews. The event is free to attend. Visit WOSU.org/events to get more information about that. Hope to see you there. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Mary Lee Williams, assistant producer Kyle McKinnon, the All Sides interns Martin Coleman, Kaylin Martin, Maisie Glockner, and Ray Brewster, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook. Follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me on Twitter, too, at Ann Fisher, WOSU. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Join us for All Sides with Ann Fisher.